Today is Friday. It's January 22nd, 2015. This is another edition of the Mincing Rascals. I'm John Williams with Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio. Hi, Steve Bertrand.
Hello, John Williams.
Eric Zorn, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, is here. Hi, EZ.
I'm here, John.
Any moment, Kristen McQuarrie may stroll into the studio and contribute as she does at the Chicago Tribune. She's a columnist there, an editorial writer. We'll get to one of her columns and yours, too.
You know what? She's cheating on us with another pundit panel.
Yeah, she's on TV. What, over on Channel 11?
Yeah, she's going to be on Week in Review tonight.
So. Fine.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, I think she's breaking up with us.
Yeah. Well, we've been contemplating a logo for, you know, online and stuff like that for this Mincing Rascals podcast. Maybe she doesn't get included in the
logo.
She's
out. She's out. She's cheating on us. She's out.
Let's talk about this headline, The Lady and the Trump. Now, that was in the New York Post, but the Daily News had a picture of Donald Trump and Sarah Palin, and it said, I'm with stupid. And each of them were pointing at each other. Sarah Palin has come out endorsing Donald Trump. He's been embracing that. Sarah Palin is a whole package. You get the good and the bad with her. Let me ask you guys this. Does Palin's endorsement of Trump help or hurt his campaign? What do you think, Steve?
I think it helps him by not helping Ted Cruz's campaign.
Yeah. That's interesting because she and Cruzy were pals.
Right.
And I think John McCain's got to love the fact that his former running mate is now endorsing the guy who called him a coward.
Right.
So thanks a lot, lady. But yeah, she takes votes away. She keeps Cruz from getting all of Sarah Palin's crowd.
Right. I mean, she could have had the event with Ted Cruz and had the same impact. But just the fact that it didn't go to Cruz, and Cruz has had such a rough couple of weeks that I think it has the impact that way. I don't know what her, I don't know what her cachet is, frankly. Or, you know, she's got no record. She has no accomplishments, but she does have a following.
It's confounding. I think that Steve is right that this helps Trump's campaign. At least it helps his bid for the nomination. I don't think that having embraced Sarah Palin like this, or having her embrace you, is good in the general election. I mean, I hate to be a name caller, but she's an idiot. I mean, her speech was just idiotic. It was like a word salad. It was, you know, talking about skirmishes.
Eric, you're in the mainstream media. Your head is spinning.
The mainstream media, the New York Times, or maybe it was the New Yorker, one of them called her speech, the endorsement speech, she's had a few, free verse poetry slam. It's ideas, it's concepts, and they're sort of melded together, but the sentence structure is bizarre.
Well, I think it speaks to it. That's what she is. She's enough. She hasn't done anything. So just her being present in her world and with some of her supporters seems to be enough. Her existence is enough.
What is her appeal? I don't align with her politically at all. And I understand the appeal of Trump. I understand the appeal of Ted Cruz. I don't understand the appeal of Sarah Palin.
You do. Well, go back to when John McCain announced her.
I didn't understand it then. She's not smart enough to be president. She's not smart enough to consult.
She gave a wonderful acceptance speech at the nomination. And it's been downhill ever since.
Well, I mean, she's an attractive female who has all of the Republican credentials or conservative credentials. Yeah. You know, she's pro-gun and pro-family and pro-God, and she speaks truth to power. She doesn't care about political correctness. That appeals to the same crowd that wants to vote for Donald Trump. And that's why I don't see her as a great addition, because he's already got that.
No, but Steve is right. She takes away from the Ted. I mean, the Ted Cruz seems to be slipping. I mean, as the polls are showing that Ted Cruz is, whatever traction he had, we spoke about a week ago, he seems to be spinning his wheels a bit. I think some of it comes from this issue of whether he's a natural born citizen or not. The polls they're taking are showing that issue is concerning to a substantial number of voters.
Right, because a substantial number of voters think Barack Obama is a Muslim. I mean, there are those people out there. The thing other that's sort of delicious about all of this is Ted Cruz has no friends in politics, in office, right? So when he's being attacked like he's being attacked, you know, when Hillary Clinton gets attacked, or, you know, Donald Trump doesn't need it, but pick another one, Marco Rubio, you've got people coming in to defend him. Ted Cruz has no real defenders because, I mean, Senator Durbin's a Democrat, but as he said on our air last week, you can count on one hand the number of friends Ted Cruz has in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, right. That was the Saturday Night Live punchline. He says, I'm Ted Cruz and no one likes me.
But that's a feature for him. The fact that people in Washington hate him is something that he talks about proudly on the campaign trail.
Yeah, I mean, it does at least paint him as an outsider. I want to go back to the language that Sarah Palin uses. I'm going to play for you a soundbite, and please listen. It's only 24 seconds, and if you have to leave this podcast for that reason, come back.
Forward ahead to, yeah.
My wife said to me, she said to me today, because I've been talking about it on my radio show a lot, I mean, how can I not, the last couple of days, and she said, please spare us Sarah Palin, and I said, I don't think I can do that. She, for whatever reason, is I'll air quotes now, legitimate. But anyway, here's Sarah Palin's endorsement of Donald Trump.
This is what we have to remember in this very contested, competitive, great primary race. Trump's candidacy, it has exposed not just that tragic, the ramifications of that betrayal of a transformation of our country, but two, he has exposed the complicity on both sides of the aisle that has enabled it.
Would you like to diagram that sentence for me, please?
I know. I'm like somebody on the sidelines going, we need a verb. We need a verb. give me a verb, Sarah.
She believes her presence is enough. She doesn't have to write a speech.
Donald Trump believes her presence.
Don was standing there a little awkwardly.
It is funny to see the look on Donald Trump's face because he's the guy who you are afraid what he's going to say next. And he had a look on his face like, I'm worried what she's going to say next.
What have I gotten into here? One point that she made that I thought was interesting and is going to resonate with a lot of voters, I think in Iowa anyway, is that the Republican establishment is rejecting Trump is not conservative enough, and so Palin, whose conservative bona fides are not questioned, grabs onto him and says, what they're saying, we're not conservative enough, that means that they have betrayed your values. And I think that this message is resonating with voters that, you know, they've elected a Republican majority to Congress, and what have they done? Nothing, really. And when they elect, conservative Republican lawmakers, and they want them to advance things like, you know, opposing gay marriage, and they want them to crack down on abortion and so on, they're not getting the bang for their vote that they want. They want more hardcore conservative action. They want things to happen.
Yeah.
And Trump is promising that. Palin says he's going to deliver it. I think it's going to motivate base voters.
I also think we won't see Sarah – well, we will, but we'll see much less of Sarah Palin after next Tuesday. I think she comes in for the splash. Donald Trump doesn't need her in other states.
And she's dangerous. Who knows what she's going to say?
She's not helpful. I mean, you know, she talks about how her son has PTSD because of Barack Obama.
Oh, that was just disgraceful. She didn't say that. It was disgraceful.
Well, but she didn't say that.
Well, what did she say, John?
Well, I mean, I'll get you the quote.
I'm sure you will, but
because I've analyzed that too, and I think this is a case where the media is stitching together a story that is even better than the story they've got.
Well, tell me what she said, because my understanding is that she was saying that yes, her son came back was he in Afghanistan or Iraq?
Iraq.
He ended his tour in 2008. Last week, he punched his girlfriend and threatened to commit suicide with an AR-15 assault rifle while intoxicated. He was arrested on 3 counts. And when she was up on the stage and Donald Trump suggested to her that she talk about this, she said how our troops are going through hell, coming back, in her word, hardened, and that Barack Obama isn't a chief executive who respects or understands what these guys are going through. She did not say, Barack Obama gave my son PTSD. She walked you right up to that line, but she did not say that.
The implication was that because Barack Obama doesn't respect returning veterans, which I think is nonsense, that this exacerbates the problem that people like Track Palin have, and that this makes them violent. And you know, war veterans reacted very strongly against this thing. That you know, to imply that people with PTSD are dangerous like this is horrible, and to imply that because of a foreign policy, their ailment is made worse.
Yeah, and you know, there's just something about the message of personal responsibility for others, but not us in this too. And I haven't sorted that out exactly, but you know, she's the one who says everyone else should be standing up by their bootstraps in all of this, and she's blaming her son's bad behavior on something exterior.
You're right about that. Well, so look at
also,
this.
Also, can I just say this, John? If we're so worried everyone should have a gun except for mental health problems, did she not say on the campaign campaign trail that her son is suffering from mental health issues? Does he have a, why does he have access to guns?
Right. If he's, I know that touche, Steve. I don't have an answer for that. 3 days into the campaign, and it's all Sarah Palin. She's not even running. She's not even yet been announced as his choice for Secretary of State or something. But she must be vying for something. Eh? Do you think she's working this hard for Donald Trump, or is she got an angle on?
She's got to be looking for another way back into the spotlight. She's clearly not a vice presidential pick. That was a disaster for McCain. Everybody knows that. She's not a cabinet. She said she was interested in being the Secretary of Energy, I think she mentioned.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
I don't see Trump doing that. I think Trump is a smart guy. I think he plays dumb sometimes on the campaign. I think he's a smart enough guy to know that she would be a disaster in any position like that.
She is a moth in search of a flame. You know, I mean, well, I think she needed this endorsement more than Donald Trump did. Yeah. I think she's desperate to be heard, and this is a way for her to be heard.
She was positively vivacious. She was just bubbling with enthusiasm and energy when she was up on that stage. The next day, they even, in fashion trends, were talking about what she wore. She is in the unique position of being able to torpedo consecutive Republican presidential campaigns.
Well, I saw a delightful thing online that showed Sarah Palin wearing that thing she was wearing at the speech, and then a Christmas tree all decked out. And the thing on it was, who wore it better?
I'm sorry, you guys, listen, we're all on the same page about this, but I think if you're fair, you've got to admit, she looked good, she sounded good. That's
She didn't sound good.
She did. That is what
the
she sounds like.
That doing?
Is, it's a little more shrill than a lot of people might like, but I'm just telling you, if you go get a Sarah Palin, that's what it looks and sounds like, and she was all of that. She didn't help Mitt Romney, but she sure didn't help John McCain.
Somebody said online, it was the other thing I saw online, was that if a sentence makes no sense read either forwards or backwards, it's a palindrome.
Okay, let's go home right now. That's it.
Metra is experimenting, they say, with Wi-Fi on some of its trains, and I'm wondering if anybody thinks this isn't a fabulous idea. They should have Wi-Fi on every train in the Metro, don't you think?
Yeah, it's like saying they're experimenting with seats.
Well, exactly.
They're supposed to be there.
And it's not that expensive. It's only costing them $35,000. It's not high-speed internet access on the rolling trains, because that would be too expensive, but that would be fabulous. Talk about money well spent. Go. I don't know why they're even dilly-dallying with it. Get it on every train and every car right now.
It's interesting they're paying money for it, because the CTA is being paid by the wireless companies to install wireless connectivity in the subway parts of the L. So if you have if you're doing a wireless signal,
right,
then you're getting your data plan. I have heard some people say they don't like this because they look upon their train ride as a time where they are not plugged in. That it's a time to read, a time to think, and that when you're not able to log in, you have an excuse not to. Now, you know, my limousine has Wi-Fi when I come into work, so
right.
So I don't have this concern. But I think there are people who feel like that we are wired in too many places, and this is too much of a temptation.
Well,
I will speak for them.
Metra has a quiet car, and I think that should be the exception rather than the rule. Maybe even a couple of quiet cars. But right now they're saying, let's have a wired car. I think the whole train should be wired and then have a quiet car or two. It's a longer ride,
well,
too.
I suspect the quietest cars are the most wired cars.
Oh, yeah, maybe so, right? Because you can just sit there and click.
Right.
Yeah, instead of chatting away on your phone. Let's talk briefly, guys, about the Oscar nomination controversy. Jada Pinkett Smith posted an interesting video this week, essentially saying she's going to boycott it, encouraging other blacks to do the same. I guess whites can as well. Her husband, Will Smith, did not get nominated for his performance in the movie Concussion. He was good in the movie. I don't think his absence from the nominees is conspicuous, but it's interesting to see how this is playing out. What do you guys think of the proposed boycott by some? Spike Lee is going to host the Oscars.
Chris Rock.
I said Spike Lee. Yeah, right. Spike Lee famously this week, by the way, said that he's not going to have anything.
He's going to go to a Knicks game, which is a terrible choice.
And it's funny because they gave him the Governor's Award in the fall for this year. He's already been awarded. And it was a very awkward, funny interview he did with George Stephanopoulos, where on the one hand, he sort of appreciated it. He liked being in the club. But on the other hand, he you know, he felt like there's a problem here. And his recommendation, by the way, Spike Lee's, was for quotas. He said that we need to have some sort of quota system. I'm not making this up.
He referred to the NFL, I think, the Rooney Rule.
The Rooney Rule, where they then started to hire more blacks, and it worked. And I think, okay, but I think that's a step backward.
Boy, that I hadn't heard that quota idea.
I think the Rooney Rule is, so if for a big job,
you're required to interview
minorities before you hire someone.
Well, I think it's just head coaching position. It could be other positions.
Well, and then Stephanopoulos says, you mean, and then he put that word in his mouth, but he didn't walk away from it. I don't know how you interview, quote unquote, for, I mean, they all have essentially been proposed as potential nominees. Nobody didn't get interviewed for best actor or actress that's black or a person of color. So I don't know how you fix this. I'm not even sure it's as big a problem as they make it out to be. But go ahead, Eric.
Well, here's the thing, that when these awards obviously come out of the movies that are made and how they are cast and who's cast in some of these prominent roles. And we, you know, Hollywood tends to be a very traditional casting mechanism. So a lot of movies are made about white people, and so they cast white people. When you look at Hamilton, the success that play on Broadway, where they cast a bunch of African-American people in the role of old white founders of the United States, you can certainly see where maybe some non-traditional casting methods could be employed. But the problem, to look at it at the end and say, it's kind of like you say, well, there are not enough black doctors, okay? Then the solution isn't to go and pick some people who are in undergraduate and say, you're a doctor, you're a doctor. The solution is to figure out, why are there not these people coming up? Why are we not getting black actors cast in these meaty roles that get Oscars? Why, and where does that come from? And look at the studios, look at the casting directors and so on. And then look at who's casting the votes. That's the other thing about this. The Academy itself is a very white organization from everything I've read. So maybe the answer is to put a little bit more diversity into the electorate.
So put a different way, then, if there were two or three African-American actors who clearly were standouts and candidates for nominations and they didn't get it, that could be a racist act, and that's boycottable. If there's not a crop of African-American actors in a given year that are in roles or competing for Oscars, then that's an institutional thing that's going to take more. And I think that's not something you boycott a single year over.
Well, an award ceremony like this is a popularity contest. So if we like Matt Damon more, for whatever reason, than Will Smith, then that's too bad for Will Smith. The greater tragedy would be if no movies were being made for Will Smith to star in. And to be honest with you, Eric, that's what Spike Lee again was talking about in that interview. He said in the show Hamilton, there's a song and a scene where Hamilton says, I want to be in the room. I want to be in the room where these decisions are being made. And I think his point is that there need to be more movies made for or about blacks. But one last point about that. The movie-going audience in America, if you ask people, are you a regular film goer, which means you see a movie more than once a month, the ratio of whites to blacks is over 6-1. 6 times more white people go see movies than black people. Now, I don't know if this is a chicken or the egg thing, but if I were going to make a movie that made me money, I think I would appeal to that audience, which can best relate to the film I'm going to make. It's probably more an indictment of all of us than it is Hollywood per se, but did you really want to go see Straight Outta Compton? I don't know that you did. Did you really want to go see, I don't know, Spotlight? Maybe you did. The box office would say you did, you know? All right, let's move on. Got a time for one more subject with me, guys?
Yeah, a couple more. Yeah, we're just hanging out here.
Well, Kristen McQuarrie hasn't walked in yet, but this is...
Kristen just texted me. She's stuck on the Kennedy. She's not going to be with us. I said I would represent her views, but I will change. I will change them to suit my own purposes.
I was just going
to
say.
Wait, I like my version better. Kristen is sitting here, but she's got nothing worthwhile to
say.
She's
got nothing. Right. She's got nothing. She's just shrugging her shoulders.
Here's the first line in her Friday column. That's today, the day we're recording this. She said, truth squatting Illinois politicians is an exhausting exercise. What a great first sentence. And then she goes on to really make an indictment about how Springfield and Chicago are handling the education funding crisis, among other things. Eric, you wrote about that this week, too. Today, in fact, right?
Yeah, Kristen and I both did columns. My column was critical of the Democrats and I'm not a fan of Rauners. Kristen is. But I feel like the Democrats have not well enough articulated their quote-unquote turnaround agenda. What do the Democrats want to do to pull the state out of the dive that it's in? And basically, they've been saying no to Rauner, and we've been stuck in this budget stalemate all year. I do blame Rauner for the budget standoff. I think that he's been stubborn, and he's not fulfilling his duty of submitting a balanced budget, and, you know, on and on. But I do think that the Democrats have not rallied the troops with any kind of program that you can really get behind and say, yeah, this is what I'm for.
Well, her point has been that when Kristen listens to this, she's just going to cringe. But I think what Kristen was saying is that Rahm Emanuel in Chicago complains that they're not getting the help they need from Springfield. But Springfield's long been a Democrat institution. And only until recently did we have Governor Rauner. Well, so this is the Democrats' problem. They don't have any legs to stand on.
The problem I have, and I wish you were here to gainsay what I'm going to say, is that the Democratic Party is not monolithic. The Democratic Party has a lot of downstate representation in it, and those people are not behind, you know, giving more money to the Chicago public schools. And so it's not like the Democrats could have easily done this if they had just wanted to. No, the difficulty with like the school funding formula is not Democrat Republican. It's more suburban downstate in Chicago, because if you change the school funding formula around to give Chicago the $500 million or so that it needs, that $500 million is coming out of somebody's pocket. It's probably going to be suburban and downstate legislators. I was talking to Jack Franks the other day, the Democratic rep from McHenry, who is people say that he's a Democrat in name only, that he's closer to a Republican. And he was saying, I'm not in favor of changing the school funding formula. He said, my constituents would get hurt. My schools would get hurt by that. What are they, you know? So it's not like the party's right. Overall, though, Kristen is right that these problems are these injuries are self-inflicted. That one of the points that she makes that's very good is that, you know, Chicago itself has been in charge of its own school system since the mid-90s and has underfunded the pension formula and has sent money streaming out the door for things like, you know, $20 million in bogus consulting contracts. I mean, it's just, you know, over and over again you see these problems that CPS has had, and now they're coming with their pockets turned inside out to taxpayers elsewhere saying, please help us out. And the taxpayers are saying, no, you have ruined this. You've had your opportunity. And I think she's actually right about that.
Well, one thing I'm not clear on is, do they need more money, or do they need to just spend the money they have more efficiently?
At this point, they need money. I mean, if you were to be able to rewind the clock 20 years or so and have them be able to go back and adequately fund their pensions and adequately do their budgets, yeah, this is not like a big surprise.
But they're also not even getting money that they were expecting, correct?
No, I wouldn't say that.
No? With the budget standoff, they're getting all the money that they were expecting?
For education, yeah, because K through 12 education is being funded by, you know, by agreement. It's higher education. It's the state colleges that are not state colleges and universities that aren't getting money. So you've got a situation where the city has not manage its finances well and is in this big hole. And the state comes along and says, okay, we'll handle it. And of course, and there's a very good Scott Stannis cartoon this morning that shows, you know, Rauner with his, you know, his car turned over in a ditch, getting out of his car, going up to a Chicago Public School bus that's turned over in the road and saying, it looks like you guys could use some help. And it's like, you know, for the idea that the state could come in and manage this problem when the state is a complete mess.
Well, where do you get the money, Eric?
You have to change the way that the tax system is. You have to get more revenue, and you have to institute some financial discipline of them. I mean, this is.
But that means in the suburbs and downstate, they're going to have to pay more in taxes for Chicago public schools
and the city. Yeah, they are. It's a tough deal to make.
Don't we pay? I don't have this number, and I shouldn't bring it up if I don't know. But I thought we paid more per student in the city of Chicago than they do downstate.
In some places downstate. And the problem is, of course, that Chicago has an incredibly high percentage of poor kids. Like something like 85% of them are, you know, on the free and reduced lunch program. And I mean, they have a lot of kids who are in poverty, and those kids are at risk. They're difficult to educate, and they, you know, a lot of kids for whom English is not their first language is a greater proportion of those in Chicago. So Chicago does have some demands. They still spend less than like a new Trier district or something like that. But yeah.
Well, it's just sad when you go to a Chicago public school and you see how they're getting along, and they're getting along. But then you go to where my son went to high school, both of them, Lyons Township High School. Granted, one of the country's great high schools, but the suburbs are peppered with those great middle schools and high schools and grade schools. It's just remarkable what a lot of money can do. And it's hard to believe that those kids don't have a leg up in public education in those richer areas than they do in the very poorer areas. That's elementary, right? But it just seems to me like the property tax funding or the means by which we're allocating the money is embarrassing.
The reliance on property tax funding is too high, and the state is not meeting its burden. It's in the Constitution of paying the majority. I think that's the primary burden of education is supposed to fall on the state, and the state falls way short of that. And efforts to change that around, to fix the formula, to make it more fair, meet with incredible political opposition.
Well, this is the last thing I'll say about that, though, and that is because I'll sound like a hypocrite now, but if you ask me what the biggest problem is for public education, I don't think it's funding. I think it's programs. I think it's what's happening in the classroom. You know, I mean, so if you got a lot more money, what would change in the classroom that's going to actually improve the education of those kids? It just seems to me like we need either more discipline in the classroom or more discipline in the administration of those classrooms with the spending that money is. If you said, what's the first thing we need to fix the schools? I wouldn't say money.
I would say smaller classes is a very important thing. And to do smaller classes, you need more resources. I think I know what you're talking about when you say discipline, is that they are unable to get kids who are disruptive out of the classroom because they don't have the facilities to educate them. So you have these situations where you have a classroom of 20 kids who are trying to learn and three or four kids who have behavioral problems or are just, you know, nasty kids. And the entire educational system is disrupted for them. I mean, one of the great things, and this is one of the great things about private education, is that they can kick kids out who are acting up, who are making it difficult for the other kids to learn. And public schools have a much, much harder time doing that.
Those private school kicked out kids go to the public schools.
Right.
Yeah,
well,
no kidding.
And that happens with charter schools too, which is part of my issue with charter schools.
No, I remember the video.
They cream off the best students, and then they say, look how well we're doing. Well, yeah, because you can get rid of kids who weren't up to snuff. So,
well, is that why one of you or Kristen said that the charter school system will be the public school system's doom?
That's probably me, because Kristen loves charter schools. Let me speak for her while she's here. She also loves my column. I'll say that.
Here's the last thing I'm going to ask you guys to do. Give me your recommendation of something to watch, read, or listen to. We just picked up the TV show Tremé. Barack Obama said that it was one of his favorite TV shows.
It's HBO, right?
We were in I think it is, Eric. I'll look it up while I'm telling you about this, but we were found ourselves in a show hole. We had
It's a terrible place to be.
Why even have a TV? So we found this show called Tremé. I'm looking it up on Wikipedia right now. It's HBO, and I'm telling you, this is really good. It's about what life was like for the citizens of New Orleans post Hurricane Katrina. It's not a documentary, but it ran 4 seasons, and it's a drama, and it's really good. The characters are flawed, they're funny, they're survivors. It revolves around musicians, restaurant workers, the people that were trying to build that town back up, and the waste that the hurricane, you know, left that town in. And it's really good. I can't recommend it enough.
You know what freezes my blood when you talk about this? You said 8 seasons.
I said 4, I thought. Why do you
just
what's
like,
your point?
Well, I'm just when I like to get into these things, it feels like there needs to be an end, and 4 seasons is a lot. It's why I haven't ever watched The Sopranos.
It just changed like so much, haven't we?
It's such a commitment to me. I want that's why I like Freaks and Geeks. 1 season and you're done. You know, you don't feel like you're missing out.
Well, it's 36 episodes total, Eric, and it'll be hard to turn off.
But isn't it amazing though that we feel the obligation to watch them all? You know, I mean, we don't watch one because we don't want to watch 36.
Yeah,
right. And sometimes once you get going, once you're in a few, you go, well, this isn't that good, but now I got to finish it.
Yeah, and how many episodes of The West Wing did I watch? I mean, I watched them all. So how many is that? Like that was like
some of them twice.
Seasons. Oh yeah,
it's like how to make a murderer. Is that this?
Yes. Making, right? a murderer.
You know, so everyone loves it. I haven't seen it. I watched the 45 minutes of the first one. I'm like, nah, I'm not going to go through this. And
really?
People are like, give it 3. You got to watch 3. You got to watch 4. I'm like, that's 4 hours. I don't think
exhausting.
I'm going to do it.
No, it's the most mentally demanding series you'll ever watch.
So anyway, last night we had a TV hole, and my wife likes to watch the sitcom Life in Pieces. which Diane Wiest is in it, and James Brolin and Colin Hanks and whatever. But the point of it is I sat there and watched two episodes and then I walked away. It just was a sitcom, you know, like the old days. You watched the TV show to kill an hour and then you moved on.
Well, it wasn't.
It was fine.
A cliffhanger? Or
no, it was fine. No, it's like just a sitcom where, I mean, there might be stories that run through it. I've watched two. I don't know, but
wow.
You know.
So that's your recommendation, Steve?
Well, no.
Your recommendation is to not watch.
Not watch TV. I'm reading Melanie Benjamin's new novel. She wrote The Aviator's Wife about Charles Lindbergh's wife and Mrs. Tom Thumb, which is a very good book. Her new one is called The Swans of Fifth Avenue, and I don't know the story at all, but it has to do with Truman Capote. She writes novelized versions of true people, real people, at Truman Capote and this sort of pod of socialites in New York who used to hang out with him, Babe Paley being one of them, William Paley's wife, and Harriman.
Avril Harriman?
His wife. She went on to become a diplomat herself. Anyway, so it's about, and apparently Truman Capote does this great betrayal in it somewhere. I'm not there yet, but the book is called Swans of Fifth Avenue by Melanie Benjamin. I'm enjoying that a lot.
I'll speak for Kristen and recommend going back online and reading all my old columns.
I knew you were going to say that.
But
I
for
knew
me,
you were going to say that.
For me, I'm recommending an article in the website Vox. It's kind of this nerdy website where they do policy analysis, and one of their top nerds is a writer named Matthew Iglesias, who is quite good and quite liberal. And his headline is, "It's time to start taking Bernie Sanders seriously." And so I'll read a tiny bit of it here. He says, "I share Sanders' admiration for the Nordic social model. I agree with him in principle about single-payer health care. I appreciate he has co-sponsored sophisticated bank regulation bills, and his advocacy of financial transactions taxes is admirable. But we in the media need to start taking his campaign seriously, and Sanders himself needs to take his campaign seriously. He needs to build a real model of higher education plans. He needs to come up with some notion of what kind of health insurance the Bernie Care single-payer plan is going to provide. A once dull Clinton coronation is suddenly looking like a potentially exciting race. That's great. But if the scrappy, not so far behind anymore underdog is content to run on vague slogans, it could also be a bit scary."
Might be a vague slogan, but his wrap-up ad for Des Moines in Iowa and New Hampshire is a beautiful ad.
It's
a
beautiful ad. Come to look for America.
Yeah, and that's just the way Paul Simon sings it, too. But it's a wonderful ad. And yeah, I'm surprised we didn't talk more about him today. I forgot about that.
Well, I'll bet you he'll be here next week. So let's give the Democrats their due in our next podcast. This is The Mincing Rascals. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or listen to us online at WGNplus.com. We're on the WGN Plus app as well, but you should have it populate your podcast icon on your smartphone. We are The Mincing Rascals. Thanks to Kristen Decker, our producer. Our engineer is Bob Ferguson. That's Eric Zorn, the mincingest of us rascals from the Chicago Tribune. Read him at chicagotribune.com/Zorn. Listen to Steve Bertrand at WGN Radio and WGNRadio.com.
The most rascally of us.
The Kristen McQuarrie. Kristen McQuarrie did not join us today because she's working for somebody else. And you can read her in the Chicago Tribune as well. I'm John Williams, and on Facebook, I'm King John. I'll talk to you on Saturday on the radio at 1, and we'll drop another podcast featuring those other guys next Friday.
You little rascal, you!